Page 94, the Private Eye Podcast.
Hello and welcome to another episode of Page 94. My name's Andrew Hunter-Murray and I'm here in the Private Eye office with Helen Lewis, Adam McQueen and Richard Brooks. We are here to discuss a brand new year of news, which happens to feature lots of things that happened an enormously long time ago, but have now burst back into the national consciousness, starting with the Post Office, because the new series, Mr. Bates versus the Post Office, has gone out and has attracted an enormous amount of attention. Richard, you obviously have been writing about the Post Office for many, many years. I did have a look. We did a Post Office special on this podcast in 2020, where we started off by saying, well, this is very, very long-running and old story, because that at that point was two decades old from the first rash of people being, you know, investigated sub-postmasters and mistresses. It was, I think, Private Eye and Computer Weekly who were the first publications to write about this.
Yeah, Computer Weekly was the first one in 2009. Alan Bates went to them and a couple of other people came forward. And then Nick Wallace, who was working for a BBC regional news programme, he picked up a couple of cases, including Joe Hamilton, who was one of the lead characters in the drama Monica Dolan played her, because there was a bit of a cluster in the southeast, Surrey, Hampshire. James R. Buthnot, the MP, was Joe Hamilton's MP. So that sort of got the ball rolling a bit. And Nick said to us, surely this is looks like something Private Eye ought to be interested in. And it certainly was. because for years, as you say, we'd been writing about these dodgy computer programs, including the precursor to Horizon, which was something installed by the Department of Social Security, as it was, to make benefits payments through the Post Office. The whole thing was a complete crock of, you know what, wasted about 700 million quid. Public Accounts Committee said, this is the worst thing we've ever seen in an IT program. You know, and that's before the scandal started.
Right.
So the government decided, the new Labour government decided they're going to salvage something for this from this. They didn't just look at it and think, oh dear, maybe start again. They said, no, we're going to salvage something from it. And then they pushed it through and it became the Horizon system. And from the outset, 1999, it was known to be absolutely plagued with problems.
I watched the first episode of Mr. Bates versus the Post Office. And I think, you know, there's a kind of upset in the way that people are suddenly tuning into this when people have been plugging away at it for two decades. But I think that the drama does a really good job of making you feel the little guy problem of it. You know, the people who sat there and they tried to do everything right. Maybe they got the auditors in because they didn't understand it, and just being confronted with this black, you know, hole of a computer system. And then one of the nicest notes that they have is, and I don't know if this is true, Rich, maybe you can tell me, the post office auditors, when they turn up, the internal post office police, sort of roll up in a fleet of Mercedes every time. You know, there's a lot of money behind the post office. And when the guy from Bridlington, you know, he's done for about £20,000 worth of discrepancy, he's also then ordered to pay over £300,000 in costs for the post office. So there is a real David and Goliath aspect to it that I think the drama brings out really well.
Yeah, it brings out this sort of contempt for the little people. You know, these were all, you know, ordinary working class people without particularly loud voices. And when they started saying, look, there's a problem here, it was much easier just to fob them off. You know, any investigation of it would have revealed a bigger problem. They knew that. But, you know, such was the contempt they had for these people, they thought they could just ignore them, and that their personal, you know, ruining their lives was, you know, secondary to protecting the reputation of the post office. And that, in fact, was a line that Paula Venables, who became chief executive of the post office, that she used when she went before Parliament. She was, you know, put in a corner. She just said, well, this is about protecting the reputation of the post office. When, no, there's sort of reputations of thousands of people being accused of theft to think of, too.
One of the things I found so extraordinary about it was the amount of authority that was actually given to the post office. And they could bring their own prosecutions.
Yeah, well, that goes
back. Who gets to do that?
Well, that goes back hundreds of years. You know, that goes back to sort of protecting the King's mail.
Could this whole thing have been avoided or dealt with much earlier? I mean, obviously it could, but I was reading a bit about it. So in 2012, the Post Office launched a review and mediation scheme, and they hired an accountancy firm called Second Sight to look into the claims that were being made. Second Sight looked into this, and it became pretty clear to them what was going on. They published an interim report, which revealed there were big concerns about Horizon. Yeah. So the Post Office stopped their work in 2015 and closed down the mediation scheme.
Yeah.
It feels like that would have been a great time for all of this to be dealt with and resolved nearly a decade ago.
Yeah, absolutely. It should have been. That work should have been seen through. That should have then been scrutinised.
Just the same thing, same institutional wall?
Second Sight were getting near to the heart of the matter, and that was the problem. That's when they had to be called off. And Paula Venables told them not just to stop their work, but to hand over all the papers that they'd acquired. And I think it was outrage over that that eventually led to the litigation instigated by Alan Bates and the 555 sub-postmasters who took the post office to court, you know, and gave them a right trouncing at the end of 2019, which is when we wrote the long special report, which we still have on the website, summarising the story.
I think the other thing that comes out very strongly from the drama, I don't know if this is your experience too, Richard, is that the extraordinary character of Alan Bates, who is just... There's pictures of him like taking all his box files up to the attic, and he kept all his records, and he refused to sign off the accounts, right? Unlike lots of the other post officers who assumed they'd made the mistake and then manually balanced the accounts, he went, I don't believe this, there's something wrong with the commuter system. He never wavered in that. And he seems to me to be, like most whistleblowers, a very unusual type of person. To be that kind of whistleblower or somebody who was a campaigner like that, you have to have a kind of, almost a kind of monomaniacal focus on it. You have to be a slightly obsessive person in a really useful way. But he's written to you, hasn't he, since the drama came out?
Yeah. Somebody got in touch with us, and I just put them in touch with Alan. And, you know, he sent a lovely note back saying, thanks for all the eye has done over the years. You know, it was important in keeping it in the public eye, in the national public eye. But yeah, his character, he is amazing. He's absolutely amazing because he's such a modest, unassuming man, but also so determined, you know, and kept his good humour throughout somehow. You know, I was saying earlier that I think, you know, when Paula Venables is stripped of her CBE, it will be, you know, Alan ought to take her place on the on the role, a sort of one out, one in type principle.
That, yeah, I don't want to make...
Possibly a K.
He should get a K, shouldn't he? I mean, if they can put him in the House of Lords, I mean, that would devastate the rest of them, which would be good fun. We're talking, you know, at the moment, the petition about the CBE has reached over 1 million signatures already. My sense is that people like David Davis have got their claws into the idea of the private prosecutions. I just don't know whether or not that will be allowed to continue, the post office being allowed to do private prosecutions. But does it feel like things are now moving and changing?
I think so. I think there is a window, as they say, that something could be done. You know, there could be big changes. It was obvious, well, 10 years ago that the post office shouldn't be doing its own prosecutions. This was one of the problems. It was investigator and prosecutor. And lots of prosecution specialists looked at it and said if the Crown Prosecution Service, an independent prosecutor, had looked at these cases, they simply wouldn't have gone forward. So that might have dealt with the prosecution problem at the start. I think that will get addressed. The other big thing is the overturning the outstanding convictions. You know, there have been 93 overturned so far and probably another 600 or so to go, which means it could take a long, long time.
People keep talking about that as though it's possible to just wade through a block book of 600 overturned convictions. Is that possible or desirable or not for any reason?
I don't know. I mean, I suspect there'll be a lot of lawyers who won't be too impressed by that idea. Right. Of the people who've appealed so far, there have been quite a lot of convictions upheld as well, which sort of gone slightly unnoticed.
Okay.
50-odd convictions upheld.
Right.
Whether they should have been or not, who knows? But, you know, it's not an easy process getting a prosecution overturned. Mm. You know, the courts are very reluctant to say that juries have got it wrong.
Presumably, in terms of the compensation claims, you know, that full legal process has to be gone through and the conviction overturned before you can even start talking about that, do you? Is that the reason for the long delays on...
I don't know. I think you can have interim payments. But on the case, yeah, with the overturned convictions, yeah, if it's compensation for being wrongfully convicted, then, yeah, that has to happen. That's why there are only, I think it's 20-something people who've had convictions overturned who have had their compensation at the moment.
It just seems extraordinary. I mean, reading the stuff you've written about, it just reminds me of that other, even longer-running case, I think, which is the contaminated blood scandal, which, you know, is also the subject of this enormous public inquiry. And we're talking about, you know, that one goes back all about, I think, the first thing that was written in the eye about it was sort of 1986 or 1987 or something.
Yeah.
And it just seems absolutely extraordinary. And in that case, the really cynical view on that one is that these are mostly, the ones who are still around are very, very unwell people, and they're just trying to play it out for as long as they possibly can.
Yeah. But, well, there's... you could be equally cynical about this. The last time we looked at the figure, it was 60 people who died having been victims of the Horizon IT scandal without getting any compensation. So that, you know, the same thing's happening there. These people weren't always young in the first place. It's taken 20 years and the inevitable does come along. I think one of the big lessons from this really is how governments and large bureaucracies deal with their own failures. Admitting you've got it wrong, they're so reluctant to do that. You know, not just the post office, but if it's, you know, HMRC dealing with tax problems or whatever, they're so reluctant to admit that they're wrong and the little guy's right for fear of all, you know, all the extra work it will cause them, and, you know, they'll get hauled up in front of a public accounts committee or whatever. But you've got to hope that this scandal perhaps teaches them that actually you'd be better off admitting early on that there's a problem, that, you know, in the long run.
The last time we spoke about this was in October when you were telling us about the reaction that the post office had to finding out about the problems with Horizon. Are there big results expected from this inquiry? Are they going to be changed in any way by the huge focus there is on this now?
The inquiry is already finding out some amazing material. You know, it's proven beyond doubt that the post office knew about these bugs at quite senior level, knew this system didn't work. It's proof that Fujitsu knew that. It's shown repeated lies by prosecutors, lawyers. So it really has unearthed some extremely useful detail. It's yet to get to the top people, though, and that will get interesting later this year.
Okay.
Paula Venables, for example, will be appearing, and she'll have to account for herself. And also, we shouldn't forget some of the executives from the early days of the earlier days of the scandal, the people who were in charge when the post office was part of Royal Mail, people like Adam Crozier. All these people set the culture of the organisation. They commercialised it rapidly. They reorganised it. They made the targets all financial, so that the chief executive's drive was just about turning a profit, which informed their approach towards shortfalls in branches, which in turn led to all the prosecutions. So the whole culture of the organisation over the last 25 years or so needs to be looked at. And that, you know, the inquiry should get to that eventually.
I've been radicalised by this story. I feel a bit about it like I do about the financial crisis when no one went to prison for it. I think when you look at the fact that all of these people...
Lots of people went to prison, Helen. Just the wrong people.
Just the innocent ones. Yeah.
But you know what I mean? I think, because it's really interesting in terms of the drama, which is written by Gwyneth Hughes, and she said she wanted to write it like Avengers Assemble, but everybody who assembles is in an Austin metro, which I thought was a really great way of doing it. And it does have that kind of sweet... Because you're right, one of the things I think they do to them that's most appalling is say, no, this is an isolated problem, this has never happened to anyone else. And then there's a kind of really very emotional moment when people kind of get together and they realise, thank God, someone understands what I'm going through. I'm not a liar, I'm not a thief, someone believes me. And I think that's really extraordinary. But, you know, the kind of drama has to deal with the fact there's very funny scenes where the big bad in the first episode is a sort of blinking computer tower. You know, it's with just Horizon written on it.
It's quite Doctor Who with no budget at all for a baddie. So we'll just have an old computer. Yeah,
but, yeah, I just think we do have this current culture where people earn enormous executive salaries, and what you're supposed to be getting that salary for is that it's supposed to be a hard job that involves making difficult decisions and taking responsibility when things go wrong. And we talked about this last time we had this on the podcast about the fact that they sort of gave themselves a bonus for looking into it. I'm like, well done us, we've done really well.
But they thought that was them doing a good thing, because all their incentives, most of their incentives are how much profit the organisation makes. That's how they get the bonuses. So, you know, the theory goes that the executives only do what they're incentivized to do. Therefore, they've got to be incentivized to deal with this inquiry properly. So 5% or something like that, only a small amount of the current chief executive's bonus, Nick Reed, was driven by, you know, dealing with the inquiry properly. But, you know, it was so tone deaf. They didn't realize that when people cottoned on to this, and also the fact that they misled Parliament about how they'd dealt with the inquiry, that really rubbed it in. But, you know, it was just, what, you want a bonus for dealing with an inquiry into a major scandal?
We should probably move on to another story of dodgy dealing at a large, nationally loved institution. You can see just well. You can see the segue tightrope. I'm completely falling off here. But Adam, something else that goes back two decades, actually, the story of phone hacking at the Mirror.
I think I can actually trump Richard on this because I think we last talked about this on the podcast in 2015, didn't we?
Yes, we did. Yeah.
And that was at what seemed like a very, very key point in the litigation as well.
I actually went back and listened to the whole thing we discussed, and I asked as a sort of hopeful last question, do you think that by the time these 98 cases against the Mirror of phone hacking have wound their way through the legal system, this will be done and people will just be able to get on with writing newspapers and reading them and, you know, will have moved on from this? And here we are.
Welcome to 2024.
From 2015 to 2024, yeah.
And it ain't over yet. It ain't over by any means
at all.
So
what's the latest?
So the latest is another stage in this actually coming to trial. Now, in absolute parallel, everyone will remember the phone hacking cases against the News of the World and latterly against the Sun as well. And they've kind of moved in parallel, the ones against the Mirror Group as well, as was now rebranded as Reach PLC. But essentially, it's been a case of them starting off with absolute denial, then conceding something, not being entirely clear about how much they were conceding. And so there having to be various stages of the litigation which are set to establish exactly what was done that was wrong specifically and what people might deserve compensation for. So these are kind of example cases which are coming up. Now, in parallel with the Murdoch operation, what the Mirror Group have desperately been doing is trying to pay off everyone ahead of any of these actual cases coming to trial. We're talking about enormous litigation here. They've already settled with 600 claimants, a cost of over £100 million. But the point is that most of them have been paid off before they can get to court, because the way that works is that if the defendants offer enough money into the court, then you are likely to get in damages. You then become liable for all of the legal costs, which is enormous.
So they sort of have to accept?
Essentially, yes. Unless they have absolutely bottomless pockets and are essentially Prince Harry.
That is so crafty.
Who was the one person who turned up? Hugh Grant wanted to do it, eventually was paid off. Charlotte Church was determined to do it, eventually had to accept the money. Prince Harry has an awful lot of money, doesn't really know the value of it, and wants vengeance. So he was prepared to push it right through to the case of going to trial and actually turning up as the first royal to give evidence in the witness box in however many hundred years that was.
Okay.
Well, that's why this is the only podcast in which you will compare Alan Bates and Prince Harry. But that is the but that's the story of both of them, of the fact that they had a single-minded focus on actually getting to the truth, right? That's the thing I thought was really fascinating about Prince Harry, is that, as you say, he had the best-selling book in Britain last year. He had a Spotify deal. He actually is probably the now most rich royal outside of the king himself. And he also just couldn't be paid off. There was just no amount of money you could offer him to not stop prosecuting his cause, right?
I'm not sure I'd exactly say that it was an absolute determination to get to the truth in Prince Harry's case. I mean, to use one of his favourite cases, it was a quest to get to his truth. And actually, the really interesting thing about this, I mean, there were 33 cases. He wanted to bring 145 instances of what he said were phone hacking. He was allowed to bring other unlawful information gathering techniques, which you say. This one isn't just about phone hacking. We'll talk about that in a second. But he was allowed to bring 33 that were actually examined in the courtroom. Of those, 18 were found out to have nothing to do with unlawful information gathering techniques. UIT is how they're referred to throughout the judgment. 15 of them he was found to. But in other cases, it came from briefings that were given out by Kensington Palace spin doctors on his behalf, or briefings from Sandhurst and all sorts of other sources. So as far as Prince Harry's concerned, everything that has been done to him is a terrible injustice, and it was all the result of illegality. That's probably not actually the full extent of it. But, you know, very evidently some of it was, as is evidenced by the fact that this entire thing kicked off way, way back in 2006, when the News of the World were found to have, in a criminal court in this case, hacked the phones of various members of that royal household, of Prince William and Prince Harry's household. So, you know, it ain't all that new, all of this stuff.
What I had forgotten until I reread your coverage in the last mag was quite how brazen some of the stories that happened as a result of phone hacking were. There's one about Harry breaking up with Chelsea Davies, his former girlfriend, in which the journalist involved is sort of quoting from things they said to each other, and you're like, how could this information have possibly reached our ears? And, you know, I think that at the time they sort of claim, well, you know, people told us stuff, but yeah, there were sort of by the end of this, I guess it was such a culture of casual acceptance that this was a well-used technique that people were sort of directly verbatim quoting people's answering machines by the end.
I think at one point, and we're going back a long way to before sort of 2006 for most of these, it was so widespread and so accepted that people didn't realise it was not an acceptable technique. That people just thought, you know, because so many people were doing it. And as it's been accepted by the Mirror Group, and which Piers Morgan is extremely cross about, it was definitely known about and sanctioned at an editorial level, right across that group and across the Murdoch group as well.
Well, it's one of the interesting things about those stories is that they really, the phone hacking stories that happened, they really freaked people out because people couldn't work out who in their circle of family or friends was betraying them and flogging stories to the papers. And
yeah, so that is the really, really sad thing. A lot of this stuff was just tittle-tattle and gossip, but also it destroyed people's lives. I mean, Jeff Brazier, who is now more famous being the dad of the son that was on Strictly Come Dancing, but, you know,
Bobby Brazier,
back in the day, was married to Jade Goody and said a lot of what led to their marriage ending was the fact that both of them were convinced that the other were selling stories to the tabloids about each other. And it was essentially, it was because they were having their phones hacked into on an absolutely industrial level, and everything was ending up that way. And of course, Jade Goody famously died back in, I think, 2004, so before any of this stuff came out, and, you know, he never got to make peace with her over that. It is, there's some really sad stuff.
So the Prince Harry case is over, ongoing?
This case is over. We still got the one against the Mail coming up, but, you know, that's probably a subject for another podcast.
Okay. So in that case, we should probably move on to Piers Morgan.
We can talk about Piers. I mean, Piers Morgan, as I made the point in the last thing, this is not new about Piers Morgan. We have known that phone hacking has been demonstrated to have been going on his watch ever since that 2015 judgment that we talked about
in
at the time back then. Yeah. So this is not news. He still maintains that he never ordered anyone to hack a phone and he never knew what was going on, which, if true, would just make him completely incompetent rather than completely corrupt. But there is a slight feeling with all of this, I'm afraid. I mean, nice as it is to see Piers Morgan humiliated in public, that we are slightly into the kind of dregs of this stuff. I mean, if you read through, which I'm afraid I have, the 385 page judgment from Mr. Justice Fancourt, a lot of this, as I said before, is not about voicemail hacking. A lot of it is about what they call this other unlawful information gathering, which in some cases, you know, is things like managing to obtain ex-directory phone numbers or making improper use of the electoral registers. Now, if you think about when this really kicked off as a story back in 2011, it was about the hacking of a murdered schoolgirl's phone and the possible, although it then turned out probable not, deletion of her voicemail messages. So in terms of the stakes, we've come down quite a long way from this, which is not to say, you know, as we were saying before, that a lot of this stuff wasn't devastating to some of the victims, but we are kind of like dragging through some stuff here.
Can I ask you, I know News Corp has decided a substantial amount of money, it's not a threat to their business to be able to kind of compensate people. Mirror is run on a much more of a, I would say, shoestring operation, shall we say. The legal liability from this must be quite significant. Is it an existential problem for them?
I think it might very well be. I mean, again, I'll come back to the 2015 judgment. That was the one that essentially set the levels of damages that were due to people. And they were stupendous. I mean, at that point, Sadie Frost was awarded $260,000 in damages. Gaza got $188,000 in damages. Then, of course, on top of that, you've got the legal costs, which the losing side has to pay, which, you know, we're talking litigation that's been going on for years and years, if not decades by this point. So, yes, it is an ongoing problem. And every year in the Reach PLC accounts, they say provision for ongoing historical legal problems, as they like to call them.
How many journalists have they laid off?
Well, exactly. That's the next point. 450 redundancies were announced at Reach, which was the second or third tranche of redundancies in the last year. So they are in an awful lot of financial trouble. That can't all be put down to the phone hacking. You know, there are all sorts of other problems facing newspapers, but it is causing them some serious trouble.
And is there any prospect of this cottage? It's not a cottage industry anymore. It's a huge factory floor. But is it going to wind? Are the mines going to be empty anytime soon, or is this going to keep going?
No, I'd imagine we'll be doing our next podcast on this subject in about 2031.
I don't even want to think about it. Right, let's move on.
The problem with these long stories, they increase the workload a bit.
And now we've got a story that I think is more recent because, Richard, we're back to Teesside, which has cropped up in the last couple of years as an enormous story for the eye. And we last discussed it a few months ago, talking about the Development Corporation and what was going on with the Teesside mayor, Ben Houchen, and all of this.
Yeah.
But there have been some very interesting new developments since then that you covered in the last magazine.
It's kind of one of the difficult things with this story is that trying to get information, you know, characterises this development is that it's of huge political importance. Rishi Sunak has sort of designated it his flagship regeneration projects at the heart of the main Freeport, the one he's always banging on about whenever anybody asks him what's the benefit of Brexit. He says, look at Teesside and so on. And they're constantly punting out PR about any minor announcement. You know, if they, you know, install a new hand dryer in the gents at the offices, there'll be a press release about, look, you know, investment in Teesside, you know. But when you actually try to get information that you want, as opposed to the information they want you to have, it all sort of clams up a bit.
And just quickly, we should say, we're not going to do the whole history of Teesside again. We covered it before. But the basic premise is there's a huge tranche of land which is very valuable, post-industrial, and maybe going to be the centre of the next big industrial, you know, regeneration of the area. It's been owned by the public sector, which has been regenerating it through a development corporation and has allowed some private businessmen to own and benefit from an enormous amount of it without much liability themselves.
They're taking out a lot of money and they're not putting any investment in.
Right.
And they're close to the private mayor, finance initiative look like an absolute bargain.
I realise, of course, that the plot of the Christopher Nolan film Tenet, which, if you remember, he spoke about as about the fact that his Peloton instructor said how boring it was, entirely revolves around a Freeport.
Get away.
It's not just Mr. Bates versus the post office. Actually, yeah. In many ways, you can think of Tenet as being the dramatisation of Richard's work.
But no one understands Tenet. That's the whole... That's the nightmare.
It is very analogous to Teesside in that respect, yeah.
Okay. So, Richard, in an attempt to untangle this, you have actually been trying to get hold of some of the figures. Using I believe David Cameron's been helping you out with this.
Yeah, Dave. Yeah, good on him. Way back in early days of the coalition, one of the not-so-helpful things they did was scrap the audit commission, which could go into local authorities and look at whether they were spending their money properly. But one of the sort of silver lining to that cloud was that they brought in some rules that really allowed for sort of armchair auditors. So it allowed local electors, and then it was amended to include journalists, to go and look at the books whenever a local authority, and the Tees Valley Combined Authority counts as one, whenever it publishes its accounts, you can say, during a sort of four-week window, you can say, I want to come along and look at the papers behind these accounts. So that's what I did earlier this year. I said, you know, I want to come up and have a look at these things. And I went up there, was put in a cubbyhole with less information than I'd asked for, and came away with some information, but some very important items that they hadn't answered, and they said, oh, well, we'll follow those up, you know, don't worry about that. Of course, a few weeks later, following up, nothing appears, and they simply won't comply with the statutory obligations, which is a bit naughty. Mm. We decided to, we'd have to, you know, enforce our legal rights and start the process formally towards judicial review, which is where you can go to court and say that a public body has not exercised its powers properly and get a judge to tell them what to do. That's not really something they want. But it has forced them to release some information. There are essentially two parts to what we still needed. On the first part, they did cough up the information and it was pretty damning. On the second part, they're still dragging their feet.
So what's that first part?
The biggest project, the biggest single item of expenditure up there is on a new quay on the south bank of the River Tees, called the South Bank Quay. It's costing about £113 million. The local authority has borrowed the money and it's paid for that. And it's just about complete. But they've sold it. They've already sold it to this company called Teesworks Limited, which is 90% owned by private businessmen. They've already sold it for £13.
£13 million.
I've checked several times.
That is now the price of a Pret lunch. I mean, genuinely.
It's £1 an acre.
You can't buy fields for that.
Yeah. We first reported that transaction a few months ago, and that's what started the whole furore about, you know, whether this was a good deal for the taxpayer, because that doesn't really sound like a good deal for the taxpayer.
No.
And the response that Ben Houch in Tees Valley Regional Mayor gave on a number of TV and radio programmes was that, no, these businessmen are paying for it. They're on the hook for that loan. They've adopted the loan. So I've been trying to establish whether that is the case, because as far as all the public authority documents it says that no, the public authorities borrow this money and we owe it. And that there is some accounting advice that they received that says more about this arrangement, which is the part we have got through this process. And that shows that indeed they are not on the hook for it. They don't owe this money. There's a separate arrangement whereby they've got this key. They lease it back to the public authority, which then has all the risks, all the environmental risks and so on. And they get an operating agreement. So they get a deal to operate this key. And if it does well, they pay some money to the authority. But it will be much less than they're earning from running the key. And if it doesn't do very well, let's say it doesn't even open properly, let's say there's no income from it, then they don't have to pay for the key at all. They're not on the hook for it. The public authority's on the hook for it. And it sort of gets to the heart of this whole project and the whole misrepresentation that surrounds it. Because the picture that's been presented by Ben Houchin in particular is that this is like a private finance initiative deal, that private investors are coming in and funding this development. The truth is they're not. They're not funding anything. They're just taking parts of it under options they have if it suits them. If it doesn't suit them, they don't have to take it. And the public sector's funding it every step of the way. So it's a big accounting ruse in a way. It's a complete false picture that we're being presented.
Last time we talked about this, Helen, you used the word skullduggery, which I thought was very legally useful.
Yeah.
I haven't seen the film Tenet, but I imagine there's a bit in it which is so shocking that you're amazed to see that on film every single time. And every time we talk about Teesside, I'm sort of astonished afresh at the things that you've been turning up. So have they responded yet? Have they responded to this?
Well,
story?
As I say, they're dragging their feet on part of it. On that part, no, they don't ever rebut.
Right.
We've kind of made this point. They don't actually ever rebut it with facts. They just say, no. No hard evidence put forward by them to, they'll say, oh, these men have taken on this loan. And you say, well, show me. Show me the contract. Show me the document. There aren't any, because they haven't.
If this were Tenet, you'd realise at the end of this that the reason you're having so much trouble getting the documents is you've been fighting Richard Brooks from the future.
As it is, what we end up with is as a headline, Private Eye takes someone else to court, isn't it? Which is up there with Man Bites Dog, isn't it?
Yeah, it could be the first time. We haven't actually gone to court, but we have won in a way.
I don't think Ben Houchin's got a big picture of you. Like, you're a kind of, you're a frequent shoplifter. Do not approach this man, dangerous, armed with the ability to understand numbers, unlike anyone else in journalism.
Talking of numbers, the new numbers are out on this because the private company I mentioned, Teesworks Limited, which is the one that's 90% owned by these businessmen led by Chris Musgrave and Martin Corney, it's just published its accounts for 2022-23. And they show that in a couple of years, up to March 23, it made profits of about £125 million. That's money for them.
£13 there in the column.
Yeah,
opposite.
That's the kind of thing that's on your debit column. Yeah, so they made about £125 million from most of it from a land transaction, which we haven't talked about. But they exercised an option again at £1 an acre to buy land that they then sold for about £75 million. That's the main part. That's not the key. The cash in on the key has yet to come. Also from keeping half the proceeds of all the scrap that was on the site, because this is a former steelwork and scrap doesn't really do it justice. It's worth a huge amount of money. All the metal, which has sold for tens of millions of pounds, they've made 40 odd million from that themselves. Then another 20 million from just moving rubble from one part of the site to another, So all told, they've made about £125 million so far without some of the big days to come.
This has been in the national papers a few times, but it has not yet achieved Mr. Bates versus the Post Office levels of publicity. Can we come up with a few casting suggestions for Mr. Brooks versus the Teesside Development Corporation?
Can I just say the young Michael Caine in Carter mode as Richard? This is how I see you, just going up and prowling around steelworks with a double-barreled shotgun of investigative journalism.
Well, that's very kind.
I want Peter Kay as Ben Houchin.
Yeah.
Oh, good.
Yeah.
Interesting choice. A comedian, but, you know, suddenly playing serious.
Comedians playing serious are generally pretty good at it, because you have to be a really good actor to do comedy, because, you know, things are either funny or they're not. You can't just brood in a corner. So
I like that.
I was thinking, because he's right sort of age, late 30s. Not many late 30s. They're all old Etonians now, aren't they? So
right.
Yes, it's Benedict Cumberbatch. His finest role is playing Ben Oucher. Yeah.
What about Corney and Musgrave? Have we got any casting suggestions for them? I don't know what they look like, actually. I've only read about them in the Meg.
When you say Corney and Musgrave, I just think of Statler and Waldorf from The Muppets.
Yeah, that's good.
Can we do the Muppets Teesside?
The Muppet Teesside Corporation. There we go.
I don't know. I saw watch a few reruns of Minder and you'll see some characters.
So where is this going? As the last question on every single section we've ever done on this podcast, where is this going next? You know, is this going to go to a judicial review?
Well, we'll see. We've got to look at exactly what they come up with on the bit they haven't answered properly. The big event coming up is that a panel that was appointed to review this, after all the fuss we talked about earlier, Michael Gove appointed a panel of people to investigate or review the project, and that has yet to report. It's been quite a while. It was due around the summertime, but I think they may have found a bit more than they expected. And the report is sort of still being finalised, I think.
Okay.
So Michael goes into the story, Andy. I wonder who will play him.
Oh, God.
Yeah, because this report will... Houchin is presenting it as that it's going to provide the big vindication, show that there's nothing wrong, and presumably vindicate his description of me as the liar in chief. So we'll see. It's showdown time.
What a twist that's going to be for the final of this drama that we're casting now, where it turns out he was the good guy all along.
Could be.
Yeah?
Or might not be. Or,
well, that's something you've definitely got to look forward to from the news in 2024. Helen and Adam, is there anything in particular that either of you is looking forward to? There are some big things coming up in the news.
I mean, it's an election year. Whether it's May or September or the very, very, very last minute that Rishi can possibly get away with it, then that's got to be exciting, hasn't it? That's always a fun. Actually, I've just done the counting. I think this is my sixth election. I don't know. We've had a lot of them recently, and even more prime ministers. But...
To
cover at Private Eye.
Oh, right.
Your first one, 2001?
Oh, God, I'd forgotten that one. Seventh. I'm even older than I thought. That's really tragic, isn't it?
Not much changed in 2001. I hardly
No, I'm sorry. Something really interesting. I was because I'm a really fun guy, I've been watching a bit of the BBC News channel lately, which is, you know, the combined international and national channel.
Well, you've got to give yourself a break from the 300-page judicial statement some point.
A bit of light viewing, yeah. But it is this extraordinary kind of hybrid beast at the moment, where they were talking about the junior doctor strike last week and talking about... in Britain's public health service, the NHS. And you thought, it's like the Prime Minister Rishi Sunak, the Prime Minister of Britain, they have to specify.
Well, they've got to cater to people watching in Ulaanbaatar or wherever.
Which is going to be really difficult to do in an election year when, you know, it's all about battle buses and Nick Robinson interviewing, you know, kind of all of the leaders and things.
That's not going to be
so interesting to people in Singapore, isn't it? So that's going to be quite a challenge. I mean, they have got some extra staff, haven't they? They've got those the five female all over 45 presenters that they tried to make redundant and said weren't needed for the new channel, who are still on full pay. So maybe they come back in and they just do the separate election channel, BBC election.
Do you know what? I'm just going to give you some recommendation. The 1997 election broadcast, which they sometimes air in full, is an absolute banger.
There's getting too tragic.
Alan, do you want to know? It's got to get more tragic. I own it on DVD. The full coverage, not just the highlights. Oh no, all of it. Frank Skinner in a helicopter. Were you still up for Portillo moments? Oh,
that's
it's
the thing.
All
everyone talks about Portillo, but actually watching James Callaghan realizing there will be another Labour government again before he dies is actually a genuinely very moving moment. Sorry, Andy, you're looking at me with abject horror.
I'm actually
you don't
thrilled.
Know how to have fun.
I'm normally the nerdiest person in any given room, and I'm seriously doubting that right now. This is great.
Absolutely,
feeling
bang.
Pretty cool over here.
Helen, what about you?
Well, just not to Trump Adams, like little tiny piddling UK elections, but if you want to see some real elections, obviously US primary season is now really kicking off. That's, you know, and we know that will be in the autumn. We're going into the Iowa caucus, followed quickly by the New Hampshire primary. You know you love this stuff.
This is West Wing fan.
This is dweeby. So, you know, there are technically some Democratic primaries, but the people standing against Biden have to be essentially write-in candidates. So that, you know, that. It's his if he wants it. Is the but the question about Trump is, despite the fact that he's facing more than 90 legal challenges, you know, more things coming out all the time, He's way ahead in the polls. I think second place to him in Iowa is Ron DeSantis, governor of Florida. Second place to him in New Hampshire is Nikki Haley, who is, I think, the strongest candidate in the field by a mile. But it just doesn't look like any of them can break through. Trump has done basically no campaigning in Iowa, whereas poor old Ron DeSantis, who I wrote a profile about, did what's called the full Grassley after Senator Chuck Grassley, which is you visit all 99 counties in Iowa. I mean, that guy's eaten a lot of butterballs and hot dogs and corn dogs and whatever, whereas Trump's just gone, but I don't want to. I just want to do increasingly weird rallies where I'd say completely random things.
Well, we've got that to look forward to. In November. I think you might have said on this pod that for the election itself, they're both going to know something important's happening, but they won't be able to remember what.
Some of the Trump campaign experience, I've got this real problem with the Trump campaign experiences, which is he just does these riffs. See also the flypaper one we talked about in the Christmas quiz, where he will say things that just do not make any sense at all. And I'm convinced that they're AI generated. And I then have to spend quite a long time going and establishing that these things did actually happen. And he did just start going, why do lemons taste weird? Or whatever it might be that week.
He's undeep fakeable.
He really is.
Amazing.
Yeah. But as far as the base goes, it doesn't seem to have mattered yet. But we will have the first evidence in a couple of weeks, probably by the time we meet here again, of whether or not anyone could actually break through, or if it'll be a Trump versus Biden rematch, which sets the tone for the rest of the year, really.
Well, keep joining us on Page 94 and you'll be hearing all of it. That's it for this episode of Page 94. Thank you for listening. Thank you to Helen, Adam and Richard for being part of it. And thank you for subscribing to the magazine. If you haven't already, go to private-i.co.uk, press subscribe, you save money, you gain journalism. All right, we'll be back again in a couple of weeks with another one of these. Bye for now.